This is KBOO Portland. It's 5 o'clock, and the KBOO Fair and Balanced Evening News team has taken the night off, so instead we will hear Free Speech Radio News in its entirety, followed by Counterspin.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 17, 2006. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Concern grows at the number of accused U.S. soldiers that reach plea deals over atrocities committed in Iraq. France's Socialist Party picks the first woman to stand a real chance of winning the presidential post. And as many as 20,000 people gear up to participate in the 17th annual School of the Americas Watch in Fort Benning, Georgia. We'll bring you those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. After months of rejecting an expanded peacekeeping force, the Sudanese government has agreed to a United Nations presence in Darfur. FSRN's Emanuel Okella reports.
During a UN-convened meeting yesterday at the African Union headquarters in Ethiopia, Khartoum agreed to an expanded United Nations package of support for the African Union force that is currently on the ground in the Darfur region. However, sticking points remain. Sudan insists that the expanded force must be African-led, African-manned, and African-controlled. That could be a potential deal-breaker for UN members who want more say in the operation. Currently, a force of 7,000 African Union troops patrols the region, but many observers say the force is too small and underfunded to prevent ongoing bloodshed. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was optimistic about the breakthrough.
All the participants came with the right spirit, the right mood, and a determination to find a solution, realizing that we cannot maintain the current impasse.
The deal could lead to the deployment of 17,000 troops plus 3,000 police, but Khartoum hasn't signed on that yet. Final details of the agreement are to be discussed at a meeting next week in the Republic of Congo. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela reporting.
Representative John Boehner of Ohio has won the position of minority leader in the 110th Congress. Roy Blunt also kept his leadership position and will be the minority whip of the House of Representatives. The Republican leadership elections for the House of Representatives firms up the House and Senate leaders when lawmakers begin a new session in January. In other news from Washington, D.C., women's groups are voicing concerns about President Bush's choice for the new head of the Family Planning Program at the Department of Health and Human Services. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Eric Kerouac is the current director at A Woman's Concern. It's a Christian women's center that discourages contraception and promotes abstinence. He was appointed to oversee the Department of Health and Human Services Family Planning Grant Program, which awards nearly $300 million to programs focused on families, teens, and low-income people's pregnancy prevention. The appointment, which does not need Senate confirmation, disturbs women's choice groups. Olga Vives is executive vice president of the National Organization for Women.
This continues to show the arrogance of this administration in that they apparently did not listen or realize that this country wants change.
The hiring of Kerouac comes the same week the president renominated six conservative judges who were previously unable to pass through the Senate confirmation process. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The country's largest owner of radio stations, Clear Channel, has agreed to a buyout for a reported $18.7 billion. One of the two major investment groups involved in the purchase of Clear Channel has been accused of violating Securities and Exchange Commission disclosure requirements. Mark Taylor Canfield has more from Seattle.
Thomas H. Lee Partners is the world's second largest private equity firm, specializing in leveraged buyouts. Private equity firms are currently the target of a U.S. Justice Department investigation into possible antitrust violations. Shareholders filed a lawsuit this week in the Manhattan Federal Court accusing Thomas H. Lee Partners of illegally conspiring to drive down the prices they paid when taking companies private. Media activists in Seattle claim that Thomas H. Lee Partners' history of litigation for unethical business practices does not bode well for the legal and financial future of the Clear Channel properties, which have dominated the U.S. media. This is Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle for Free Speech Radio News.
In Uruguay, a former dictator and ex-minister of foreign relations have been arrested. They will both face charges of involvement in the murder of their regime's critics. Asli Pellet reports from Montevideo.
A judge ordered the arrest of the two former officials yesterday. Ex-dictator of Uruguay, Juan Maria Bordaberry, soon after turned himself into the police. His then-Minister of Foreign Relations, Juan Carlos Blanco, was arrested immediately. The men are accused of involvement in the killing of two left-wing politicians, Zelmar Michelini and Hector Gutierrez Ruiz, and two militants, Rosario Barredo and William Whitelaw, who were executed in Buenos Aires in 1976. The Uruguayan judge ordered 10 years of prison for both men without possibility of early release due to the seriousness of their crimes. Some 180 Uruguayans were killed during the 12 years of military rule. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Asla Pellet in Montevideo.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
News outlets were full this spring with allegations of brutalities committed by U.S. troops in Iraq. Now, many of those soldiers are facing their day in court, but some observers are concerned at the number of accused who have reached plea deals with the military. FSRN's Aaron Glantz reports.
This spring, the Pentagon announced that a group of Marines went to the home of a 52-year-old disabled Iraqi, took him outside and shot him four times in the face, and then framed him to look like an insurgent. Now, many of the soldiers involved are in court, but four of the accused have reached plea agreements with military prosecutors. Gary Solis is a former prosecutor at Camp Pendleton who teaches at Georgetown University School of Law.
These are not just pretrial agreements with an offer with an agreement for the accused to testify. The accused gets, in a sense, two deals. First of all, he pleads and gets an assured sentence that is shorter than he might otherwise get. For example, at Camp Pendleton, an accused pled and was sentenced to 18 months, and the judge, had there not been a pretrial agreement, said that he would have sentenced him to 5 years. But in addition, they're pleading to reduce charges.
This week, for example, Lance Corporal Jerry Shoemate pled guilty to charges of aggravated assault and conspiracy to obstruct justice in connection with the killing of the disabled Iraqi. Shoemate will serve 18 months in prison. His attorney, Steve Immel, would not speak on tape for this story, but said the prosecution, quote, showed maturity in understanding how difficult and dangerous it is to be an American soldier in Iraq. That outrages Gary Solis, the former prosecutor at Camp Pendleton.
Who is representing the deceased in these cases? Who is looking out for his interests? If everybody gets to plead to reduce charges, is the justice system working as it should?
Another problem, say watchdogs, is that a very small percentage of crimes committed by U.S. troops result in prosecution. Rahul Mahajan runs the blog Empire Notes. He talks about one case in Afghanistan.
Look, for example, at the case of two young men killed in Bagram by repeated strikes to their bodies that basically destroyed the tissue on large parts of their bodies, and where the coroner actually wrote down the cause of death was homicide. 27 different soldiers were involved in killing these two men over a period of some weeks. Nobody was been charged with anything more than minor crimes, because the final upshot was they said that since they couldn't determine which strikes actually ended up killing these people, they couldn't charge anyone for murder, which is the kind of argument that, you know, would never fly in a million years in an ordinary civil murder case, but flies because the military makes up its own rule.
It's difficult to know how many Iraqi and Afghan civilians have been killed by the U.S. military. Sarah Holwinski, director of the Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, says that while U.S. law entitles victims to file claims with the military, many Iraqis do not for security reasons.
The country is in such disarray that it's very hard for people who have been harmed by U.S. operations to actually go to the claims offices. They can't travel outside of their homes or neighborhoods, and certainly as soon as they go to a claims office, they might be targeted or kidnapped.
A Pentagon audit of one emergency fund found the military provided more than $14 million to civilians in 2005 in compensation for death, injury, or property damage. But the audit does not show how many families were compensated and does not reveal how many were turned down and why. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
France's Socialist Party has chosen Ségolène Royal as its candidate for next year's presidential election. As FSRN's Tony Cross reports from Paris, she's the first woman to stand a realistic chance of winning the post.
voudrais simplement vous dire le bonheur que je ressens. Voilà, je suis très heureuse.
Ségolène Royal thanks her supporters after hearing that she's won the Socialist Party nomination with over 60% of party members voting for her. She left the two other candidates, former Finance Minister Dominique Strauss-Kahn and former Prime Minister Laurent Fabius, trailing with 21% and 18% respectively. Political differences were difficult to make out during the televised debates that preceded the vote, with all candidates swearing loyalty to the party's programme of modest reforms, such as raising the minimum wage, full employment and sustainable investment. Despite a far from radical record in office in the mid-1980s, Fabius campaigned as the left-wing candidate. One of his supporters, Claude Bartholomé, put Royal's victory down to massive publicity and the support of thousands of newly enrolled party members.
On a eu le droit à près de 30 sondages. On a eu aussi.
We were served up nearly 30 opinion polls, and new members made their choice in isolation from the rest of the party. But that's not so important now. What matters is this nomination and the will of the socialists to join together to win the presidential election.
Royal won't be the first woman to stand for president. Trotskyist Alette Laguiller has stood 6 times. But she is the first woman to stand with a chance of winning, and that's boosted her image as a breath of fresh air in France's political atmosphere. But apart from proposals to stop government aid to companies that relocate outside the country, her politics seem to veer to the right of the socialists' official line. They include questioning the value of the 35-hour week, introduced by her own party, and proposing boot camps for young delinquents. The former director of Le Monde newspaper, Henri Fontaine, hopes that she will be France's Tony Blair.
She thinks by herself. She's not a slave of party's slogans. Very frequently, it's easier to make a slightly rightist point when you are labeled leftist. France has not yet made a Blair or a New Labour mutation, and I think she's probably ready to that. Look at what she has said about the 35 hours a week. It shows that she's not linked by the usual speech of her party.
The mainstream right UMP has not yet chosen its candidate. Controversial Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy is already running an unofficial but much publicized campaign, and far-right leader Jean-Marie Le Pen is already in the race. In 2002, he made it through to a runoff against mainstream right-winger Jacques Chirac. These two opponents may well rally left-leaning voters around Royal when it comes to casting their ballots next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
An Asian human rights group has condemned the Philippine government's failure to investigate a growing number of extrajudicial killings and forced disappearances in the country. The Asian Human Rights Commission has also called on authorities to look into the cases of forced disappearances with the same urgency as political killings. As FSRN's Gurley Linnau reports from Manila, families of disappeared persons are appealing for urgent help in hopes that their relatives are still alive.
4 years ago, Dibat Nagairoso, a mother of 2 young children, lost her husband when gunmen abducted him in the northern Philippine province of Nueva Ecija. Up to now, Airoso's husband, Honorio, has not been found. Honorio was organizing for the leftist party-list group Bayan Muna when he and fellow activist Johnny Orsino were abducted by armed men on February 9, 2002. In 1989, Honorio was also forcibly taken by soldiers, who detained and tortured him for 10 days before charging him in court for allegedly being a communist rebel. He was later acquitted and released. Airoso fears that her husband would not be as lucky this time.
At the start, I was still hopeful. But when I recalled his stories about his first abduction, the torture, then I remembered what he said then, that if he was taken again, he will no longer come out alive. It's difficult to accept that he is no longer coming back. While I know he is not coming back, it is more difficult to accept that he is already dead.
Airoso and many other families of missing persons believe that soldiers or policemen were behind the disappearances of their relatives as part of a campaign to eliminate persons critical to the government. Since the first case of a forced disappearance was recorded in 1971 during the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos, more than 1,800 people are now missing.
Many of the victims are human rights advocates and workers, leftist activists, and labor leaders. Michael Anthony, program coordinator of the Asian Human Rights Commission, said the forced disappearance of even one person was alarming and should be investigated by Philippine authorities. In a fact-finding mission in the Philippines in July, Anthony said his group found out that a task force created to investigate extrajudicial killings is not looking into the increasing number of forced disappearances in the country.
The head of this unit, when asked about whether or not they were investigating forced disappearances, stated that they need to have a body to launch an investigation. So they are not at all treating the question of forced disappearances. And this to me is a very significant problem. The people that are conducting these killings only need to ensure that the body of a person is never found to basically ensure that there are no effective investigations of any type into these events. Added to this is the possibility of people still being alive when they disappeared. So we would hope that investigations would be able to find these people so that they are not killed.
Guy Portahada, spokesperson for the families of the Desaparecidos for Justice, said the incidence of forced disappearances has again worsened under the administration of President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo since 2001. There are already 186 victims of forced disappearances in the past 5 years. Portahada herself is a victim of forced disappearance, with his father, a labor leader, missing for the past 19 years.
I really hope that the government will take some kind of action to stop these abductions of its citizens. Instead of taking its citizens, the government should take care of their needs. But I guess this is really what they want, to silence those against them. But that's where the government is wrong, because entire families are enlightened when a relative becomes a victim of forced disappearance.
As families continue to search for missing relatives, even 2 decades after they disappeared, leftist lawmakers are now pushing for the passage of a new law that would compel authorities to conduct investigations on reports of forced disappearances. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurli Linao in Manila.
Junin is a community within Ecuador's Intag Cloud Forest region, a place considered to have one of the world's greatest biodiversity. But it's also the site for a proposed open-pit copper mining project by a Canadian company listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. As Kasim Termizi reports, residents of Junin and surrounding communities are resisting the proposed mining project.
Ascending Copper Corporation, a Canadian company involved in exploration and mine promotion, acquired the mining concessions in Junin in 2004. Companies like Ascendant perform feasibility studies and mine speculations, and later sell the project to larger mining companies. Jose Garzen is a farmer and the president of joint parishes of the township of Cotacachi. Intag is a part of the township of Cotacachi.
Al Ascendant, por muchas asambleas, muchas reuniones, se le ha dicho fuera.
In many assemblies and town hall meetings, people pronounced that Ascendant should leave and that we want peace. On May 20th of this year, there was an assembly for the zone of Intag, where a similar resolution came out rejecting the mining project. There were about 800 people in this assembly, and they rejected the project. Of course, there was a group who supported the company, but they represented no more than 25 people.
No habría más de unas 25 personas que apoyaban a la empresa.
According to the Ecuadorian constitution, the government must first consult with communities that will be affected by the environmental impact of a project like an open pit mine. Residents opposed to the project say that no such consultation took place when the transfer of the Junin mining concessions took place. A court later decided to allow the transfer of concessions. According to local media reports, on November 1st, about 60 people working for an agricultural company contracted by Ascendant Copper to apparently do farm work tried to enter 2 towns in Intag. Opponents of the mining project say that the so-called agricultural workers physically attacked local mining activists when the locals asked about the workers' business. Residents say that the workers had tear gas canisters, firearms, and machetes with them. Edmundo Lucero is the president of the town of Junin. He explains why he thinks the reported attack is part of Ascendant Copper's strategy to force the mining project into the area.
La empresa lo que ellos quieren es dividirnos.
The company wants to divide us, provoke us so that we react, so that they have options to bring us to court, to have warrants for the arrest of leaders fighting the mining project, in order to send them to jail or make them run away. Also, they are trying to provoke us so that they have reason to bring the military into the area.
Opciones para que haya una tres militares aquí a la zona.
In the 1990s, new mining laws were introduced in Ecuador that were to support increased investment. Ricardo Boitron of Ecological Action, an Ecuadorian environmental organization, comments.
Aquí se han hecho reformas a las leyes mineras.
Here, mining law reforms were done with the financing of the World Bank. But not only that, the mining law reforms were written by the lawyers of mining companies.
Fueron hechos por los abogados de las empresas mineras.
According to recent reports, Ascendant Copper hopes to begin drilling once an environmental impact study is completed. Opponents of the mining project say that they will continue resisting. Reporting from Junin, Ecuador, for Free Speech Radio News, I am Qasim Termizi.
This weekend, the 17th annual gathering of School of the Americas, or SOA, watch outside the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, is expected to draw a record crowd of 20,000 people. Participants from throughout the world come to honor the tens of thousands of Latin American civilians who have been persecuted, tortured, or killed at the hands of graduates of the school. The participants' goal is to close the school, either by cutting its U.S. funding or by draining the pool of soldiers from countries throughout Latin America, about 1,000 of whom attend classes at the school every year. Organizers have made progress on both fronts this year. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Every year, thousands of students, priests and nuns, veterans, and other social justice advocates descend on Columbus, Georgia. They come for a weekend of workshops, music, puppetry, and a solemn commemoration of those who have died at the hands of graduates of the school, now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or WINSEC. More than 170 people have spent a total of 78 years in jail for trespassing onto the base to protest the military training soldiers receive there. Many people have come year after year, drawn to the inspiration and intense camaraderie to be found outside the gates. Molly Wheeler is one of them. She has a special connection to one of the small number of North Americans who've paid with their lives for standing with the poor of Latin America.
My mother was a Mary Knoll nun and had been the same year as Edith Ford and had known Edith Ford and Maura Clark quite well, the two of the four church women that were killed in El Salvador December 2nd, 1980. So that was just part of kind of the landscape of growing up.
Wheeler went for the first time last year and headed down again yesterday from New Haven, Connecticut. She describes what drew her back.
It's pretty heartbreaking on one hand because there's people there that have been tortured or have lost family members at the hands of the SOA. And you hear these stories and you bear witness to these people's experience. But on the other hand, it's very uplifting to know that so many people will travel to the middle of nowhere. Last year there were 19,000. It was the biggest crowd ever. And that people would travel that far to demand some action.
SOA Watch staffer Joao da Silva says in recent years, SOA Watch founder Father Roy Bourgeois and others have led delegations to many Latin American countries, asking their leaders to stop sending soldiers to WINSEC for training. Not surprisingly, Venezuela, under President Hugo Chavez, was the first to do so, followed by the leaders of Argentina and Uruguay. Da Silva says that Bolivian President Evo Morales has also talked about removing troops from WINSEC. Morales himself suffered repression and human rights abuses under a former Bolivian dictator trained at the SOA.
The same thing was said by the Minister of Defense in Chile, who said she would recommend the military to stop sending troops. The issue is that the militaries in South America still hold a lot of power and a lot of influence, so it's very challenging to, you know, to propose to leaders of these nations to demand from their militaries to stop sending troops.
Seven Latin American countries will be holding simultaneous events this weekend to protest militarism in Latin America and U.S. foreign policy and to call for closing SOA WINSEC. They are Chile, Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, El Salvador, Paraguay, and Colombia. Almost all countries ruled by U.S.-supported military dictatorships in the 1970s and 1980s that practiced widespread torture, rape, and murder of their own citizens. In recent years, democracy has broken out across the continent, and for some of these governments to continue sending their soldiers to a U.S. training center, some of whose more recent graduates have also committed human rights abuses, seems anomalous. In recent years, the countries sending the most soldiers for training are Colombia and Mexico. WinSec's website states that its mission is to promote peace, democratic values, and respect for human rights through inter-American cooperation. But critics say it promotes military control of civilian populations, often through intimidation and outright violence. As inspiring as the actions at Fort Benning are, the real goal of the work is to shut down the school. To that end, thousands of SOA Watch supporters campaign year-round, sending letters to elected officials and lobbying in Washington. A bill has been introduced in Congress almost every year to cut U.S. funding. Last year, it lost by 15 votes in the House. But 20 opponents of the bill to cut the funding lost their seats in this month's election. No one knows yet how their replacements would vote, but DeSilva is optimistic that the new Congress may vote to approve the bill when it's introduced next year.
We're definitely going to target all the new members of the House and the new members of the Senate.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tihus in New Haven.
As Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Jordanian Prime Minister Maruf al-Bakit signed into agreement a memorandum of understanding covering 17 key areas of trade, social development, and media cooperation yesterday in Jordan's capital of Amman, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters wrapped up its 9th World Conference. Community radio broadcasters from more than 94 countries attended the event to analyze and explore the challenges facing community radio. FSRN's Jackson Ellers reports from Amman.
Although definitions of community radio differ from country to country, one thing that was clear during the 9th World Conference of AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, was that grassroots radio is a force to be reckoned with in the 21st century. Early in the week, conference organizers issued a statement affirming what they described was a fundamental right for people in every social and economic strata to have equal access to information. It was among the major themes of the conference. Kolowenyoni is an advocacy officer with a community radio initiative, Radio Dialogue Bulawayo, in Zimbabwe. Like many conference attendees, she said that the existence of bottom-up forms of broadcast mediums that provide for public service are more myth than reality.
People in Zimbabwe do not own the radio. Radio is brought to them by someone. Content is determined for them. They never really do have the platform to speak about issues that affect them. And speaking out in Zimbabwe is really closed. And we have laws like the Public Order and Security Act. For 5 people to gather and discuss an issue, you need to notify the police.
Daoud Kutab is the founder of the Arab world's first community radio station, AmanNet. AmanNet, which started as an internet radio station in 2000, hosted this year's 9th Association of World Radio Broadcasters Conference. Although most of the Arab world has traditionally put tight clamps on its broadcast media, AmanNet has the support of the Jordanian monarchy. But AmanNet's founder, Kutab, said that there is no guarantee that they won't face problems in the future.
I don't think we give them a lot of clear-cut excuses to kind of close us down. If they would do it arbitrarily, I think they would suffer. I don't know. We've been okay with them, and they seem to be okay with us. They're logically, we don't have an axe to grind against anybody except anybody who messes up the public. We defend the public. We are community radio, and our role is to defend the community.
Indeed, community radio worldwide, both in highly industrialized countries like the United States and in the developing world, face continuing pressure by governments attempting to control the dissemination of information, this according to AMARC organizers. Zain Ibrahim, founder of South Africa's first community radio station, Bush Radio, and described by many as the godfather of African community radio, says that much of these problems can be solved by how community radio is presented to those in power.
You go to an Arab country like Libya, Tunisia, and talk to them about freedom of speech, you're out the door so fast your head will spin. But you talk to them about saving money, developing the people's dignity, about poverty reduction, environmental issues. Do you want to save money on health? Aha! I tell you how. Community radio.
The 10th AMARC World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters Conference is scheduled to be held in Latin America in 2010. With help from Norm Stockwell and Andrew Stelzer, this is Jackson Allers reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Amman, Jordan.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Ada Bogado.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 529, and stay tuned for Counterspin. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance. the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991.
The Cable Board of Directors meets on Tuesday, November 21st from 6 to 9 p.m. This is a new and permanent time, and you, gentle listeners, are invited to attend to see your community radio station, KBOO, in action. How are decisions arrived at? What's on the horizon for Cable? These mysteries are sure to be revealed to you next Tuesday, November 21st from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Cable Board of Directors meeting. Won't you please join us then? That's 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, one half block south of Burnside.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Barack Obama wasn't running for anything this election season, but you might have thought he was, judging from the media coverage he generated. Obama's appeal extends across the political and pundit spectrum. Indeed, finding anything approaching critical coverage of the freshman senator is next to impossible. So what's going on here? Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report joins us to talk about it. Also on Counterspin today, we know that media can turn any factoid into a phenomenon when they choose. After the last election, we were subjected to months of discourse on how voters put moral values above all else based on a single exit poll question. So what will media make of the fact that in the midterm elections, proponents of so-called free trade agreements were handed their hats, especially given that those trade agreements enjoy such unequivocal endorsement in the elite media? We'll hear from Chris Slevin of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Well, the lesson the media took from the midterm elections was that conservative Democrats were the real winners. The Washington Post's editorial page stuck to that script on November 14th when they argued against Congressman John Murtha's bid to become majority leader. The reason? Murtha's against the Iraq War. But when the Post sought to make its case, things got a little muddy. The paper argued that, quote, Al-Qaeda is known to play a major part in the insurgency, close quote. But it's widely agreed that Al-Qaeda are a small part of the mostly homegrown Iraqi insurgency. The Post also claimed that Murtha's call for redeployment of U.S. troops in Iraq is, quote, an extreme step that most congressional Democrats oppose, close quote. Well, that's hard to square with the fact that about half the Democrats in Congress have co-sponsored Murtha's resolution. It's proof, if any more were needed, that some positions on the Iraq War, supported by large segments of the U.S. public, are derided by the mainstream media. With the debate over withdrawing troops from Iraq intensifying, the New York Times splashed on its November 15th front page a story that was headlined, Get Out of Iraq Now, Not So Fast, Experts Say. The Times saw fit to rely on just three experts, former military officers Anthony Zinni and John Batiste, and Ken Pollack of the Brookings Institution. The latter was one of the most forceful proponents of the Iraq War, arguing across the media that Iraq's WMDs were a true threat to the United States. Why such voices should be trusted now is hard to figure. Then again, that's true of the Times reporter who wrote this story, Michael Gordon. He was the lead author of the Times' famously discredited pre-war story about aluminum tubes Iraq was using in its nuclear weapons program. Being that wrong never seems to disqualify anyone from being a media expert.
Well, it's rare that women make it to the top of U.S. politics, but what's not rare is how most are treated by the mainstream media. One staple of such coverage is the obsession with clothes. We aren't really sure what kinds of suits Trent Lott wears, but we sure know what designer labels incoming Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi prefers. That's not the only brand of media sexism, of course, and Pelosi's sudden media stardom has brought out several varieties. Washington Post columnist David Broder, for one, cheered Pelosi's bipartisanship after the midterms, writing on November 9th that, quote, her debut as leader of a congressional majority was pitch perfect, calm, confident, and blessedly free of the screeching tone of some of her stump speeches, close quote. A screeching woman. Now that's a new one. Perhaps you could give Broder the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he really meant Pelosi was speaking too loudly at a campaign rally. Consider the comment, though, from MSNBC host Chris Matthews. On his November 13th show, Matthews was weighing in on the battle among Democrats for majority leader. Pelosi was backing John Murtha against Congressman Steny Hoyer, leading Matthews to blurt out, quote, is she going to castrate Steny Hoyer if he gets in there? Close quote. So you get that. Powerful women as screeching, castrating threats. Power may have changed hands in Washington. Crude media sexism isn't going anywhere.
Spinning language to try to force your own interpretation of an issue is a time-honored technique, but you've got to admit that U.S. conservatives have gone at it with particular relish, coaching proponents to say climate change instead of global warming, for example, or to talk about having personal Social Security accounts instead of privatizing them. In the same vein, Republicans pushing for the repeal of the estate tax that only affects about 2% of U.S. families, but whose repeal, by congressional estimates, could cost treasuries billions of dollars, insisted on referring to the death tax, which, besides sounding spooky, implies a cost paid by everyone who dies, rather than a wealthy few. It was one of the more obvious, even laughable attempts to spin an issue, and most reporters, if they use the phrase, set it up with a what conservatives call, or at least a so-called. CBS's Cheryl Atkinson must have missed that memo, though. There she was on CBS Evening News on November 9th, offering a post-election assessment about how Democrats would be moving into the driver's seat after 12 years of being backseat drivers, as she put it. In terms of fiscal policy, Atkinson explained to viewers, Democrat Charlie Rangel's becoming chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, quote, might mean higher taxes on upper-income Americans and perhaps reinstituting the death tax, close quote. I suppose we should be grateful she didn't suggest those tax and spend Democrats would declare class warfare.
Well, when the wrong people win Democratic elections, sometimes journalistic standards of accuracy and fairness get thrown out the window. This was true of a November 12th Washington Post report about the victory of Sandinista presidential candidate Daniel Ortega in the November 5th Nicaraguan elections. Post reporter N.C. Eisenman summarized recent Nicaraguan history like this, quote, through a controversial decade-long campaign of ambushes and sabotage, the Contras, estimated to number as high as 12,000 at their peak, helped pressure Ortega into holding elections in 1990 in which voters swept him from office, close quote. Aside from that overly polite description of the murderous campaign of terror waged by the Contras as ambushes and sabotage, the piece glaringly omitted the 1984 Nicaraguan elections, in which Ortega won 67% of the vote in balloting that international observers found to be free, fair, and hotly contested. It also ignores the fact that the 1990 elections were held not because of Contra pressure, but as scheduled by the Sandinista-written Constitution. Interestingly, the piece referred later to the Contras as, quote, armed, trained, and largely run by the CIA, close quote. This is a fact, of course, but it's a fact that Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz has denied in broadsides against Contra crack scandal reporter Gary Webb. Surely Kurtz won't let a Post reporter now make the same hideous error in his own paper.
And finally, though it's hardly the first lie George W. Bush has told while in office, his assurance to reporters 2 weeks before the midterm election that Donald Rumsfeld would stay on as Secretary of Defense was perhaps the first lie Bush has actually admitted to, as he did at his November 8th press conference. While it's evidently extremely hard for Bush to cop to his lies, it seems the press corps has an even harder time with it. There's something of an unwritten rule in the mainstream media that, as the former New York Times Bush beat reporter Elizabeth Buemiller put it, you can't just say the president is lying. In the wake of Bush's Rumsfeld lie, that rule was echoed by the Washington Post's Howard Kurtz, who noted on November 9th that, quote, journalists by nature shy from pinning the liar label on any political leader, close quote. That observation came, appropriately, under the Are They Really Serious headline, President's Evasion Raises Truth Issues. But the Post had actually seemed to defy the rule when, immediately after Bush's press conference, a report on their website noted that Bush, quote, appeared to acknowledge having misled reporters, close quote. Blogger Glenn Greenwald took note, but then he was startled to find out that sometime soon after publishing the article, the Post edited the piece and deleted that phrase. It had also changed a line saying Bush, quote, had made the decision to replace Rumsfeld before the elections, close quote. They replaced that with one saying he had only contemplated the ouster. As Greenwald pointed out, the original version was completely accurate, and the Post left no indication that it had made the change in the new version, leaving no trace of the excised truth except in the blogosphere. Apparently, the Buemiller rule is so strict that you can't just say the president is lying, even if he admits it himself. And if you do accidentally say that, you'd better go back and unsay it.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
He wasn't running for office this campaign season, but judging by the volume of media coverage, you might have thought that freshman Senator Barack Obama was. The very sudden rise of Obama's political career has reporters pegging him as a serious contender for the White House in 2008, and he enjoys praise across the pundit spectrum. In an age of sparring TV talking heads, Obama's bright political future is one thing they all seem to agree on. So why is that? Well, Glenn Ford is the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, a weekly online magazine of African-American political thought and action. He joins us now to talk about that. Glenn Ford, welcome to Counterspin.
Oh, so glad to be here.
Now, it's hard to overstate the media's love for Obama. Right-wing pundits like David Brooks, Charles Krauthammer have cheered on talk of a White House run while even acknowledging that there are these ridiculous expectations out there. Joe Klein of Time magazine wrote that Obama, quote, transcends the racial divide so effortlessly that it seems reasonable to expect that he can bridge all the other divisions and answer all the impossible questions plaguing American public life, close quote. What do you make of all this?
Barack Obama is a prince of ingratiation. That seems to be his principal talent. In the process, of course, he commits acts of betrayal of his former self. As a Illinois state senator from the south side of Chicago, Barack Obama was a sterling progressive. Mm-hmm. He was a champion of universal health care. But all that changed when he decided he would run for statewide office. And we have seen him drift rightward and rightward and rightward ever since, in actually a record-breaking span of time.
And as he drifts further right, the media can't seem to get enough of it.
What he has done is give, let's put it very bluntly, he has given white people a kind of satisfaction that race no longer matters in America and that all the sins of the past can be washed away through the act of loving this man. They really do love him. And he's encouraging that. I think it's quite cynical.
Now, let's talk about Iraq. You mentioned his past, and that is part of his past. Probably one of the only things the Democratic base knew about him was that he was opposed to the Iraq War very early on. New York Times columnist Frank Rich claimed recently that, quote, it's important to remember that on one true test for his party, Iraq, he was consistent from the start, close quote. Where's Barack Obama today on Iraq, though?
You know, he began reversing on that very early. In his early campaign, he displayed on his campaign website his rather fiery speeches mm-hmm. against the war. After he won the primary, he took all of that material off of his website. as if it had never existed, in anticipation of running statewide. He put that whole machine into reverse. So this is not something that's just happened since he won election. It happened after he won the primary.
It's important to remember, too, before his career really took off, the National Democratic Party didn't have a keen interest in him. He wasn't their favored candidate out of Illinois. So he did rise rather quickly. One of the terms you hear constantly, and we touched on this before, but we should talk about it some more in the coverage of Barack Obama, is this idea that he, and this is the phrase you hear all the time, he transcends race. It's not the first time we've heard something like this. Certainly Barack Obama isn't the first African-American politician who's been tagged with this label. It's a euphemism for something. What do you think
Absolutely.
That means?
That's the word. The euphemism for transcending race is a euphemism for erasing race. And if you can erase race, then you don't have to deal with race. And Obama has made himself a receptacle for those who would erase race as an issue and therefore not confront the central problem of domestic problem of the United States, which is race and has always been.
Now, you write in the current edition of Black Agenda Report, you write about race in the elections. It involves Harold Ford. It also involves Barack Obama. A lot of the themes that you see in coverage of Obama is true of Harold Ford. He's loved by radio hosts like Don Imus. They can't get enough of Harold Ford. And yet, as a politician, he's one of the few Democrats who was running that isn't going to the Senate come next year.
Harold Ford was the most right-wing member of the Congressional Black Caucus. He aggressively put himself forward in speaking engagements and seminars as a model for what the black politician of the future should be, that he was part of the new wave of black politicians. We at Black Agenda Report consider him to be the most dangerous black man in the country because of that. If he had ascended to the Senate, then he would, in fact, just because of his presence in the Senate, have been considered the role model for black politics, signaling a turn to the right among black politicians, and also an indication, a false indication, that black people as a whole have turned to the right.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that in these past elections, the ideal outcome was achieved, that the Democrats did gain control of the Senate, but Harold Ford lost, and we celebrate that fact.
Well, speaking of what the mainstream press was celebrating, going into this election, you had Harold Ford, Michael Steele in Maryland, Lynn Swan in Pennsylvania. There was a story that the media seemed really eager to write about this election. The problem was that the election didn't seem to turn out that way, and the disappointment was almost palpable among some of the pundits that we wanted these guys to win and they didn't come through for us. Why were they so heavily invested in these campaigns and these candidates?
The same reason. They want to see what they have predicted or even put forward a so-called analysis existed, that black people are turning to the right. Now, it's very, very important for them to believe this, because blacks are the most progressive voting bloc in the nation. You know, we don't make up that large a proportion of the population, about 13% of the population, but because we vote so consistently progressive, that multiplies our weight, and it also is a reminder that things are not right in this country. If black high-profile right-wing candidates are successful, then it tends again to say that race is no longer a problem and we don't have to do anything about it. It's all part of the same cloth.
And a real disappointment to a lot of the professional pundits who will keep trying to write this story. Well, we've been speaking with Glenn Ford. He's the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. It's a weekly online magazine of African-American political thought and action. You can read and listen to Glenn's work at blackagendareport.com. Glenn Ford, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for inviting me.
In
In the midterm elections, as with any event, corporate media tend to zero in on a few favored storylines, while others may be noted and forgotten. Pundits allowed a single ambiguous exit poll question about values to provoke months of debate about red states and blue states, for example, and supposed moral fissures dividing the country after the last election. It remains to be seen just how deeply or thoughtfully media will explore the implications of one of this election's more marked results, namely the defeat of politicians who were supporters of so-called free trade agreements like NAFTA, and the victories of candidates who actively reject those policies. Joining us now to discuss what happened and what journalists might take away from it is Chris Slevin, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Welcome back to Counterspin, Chris Slevin.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
Well, start us off with what Global Trade Watch found in your analysis of the midterm election results in terms of questions of trade policy.
Sure. Even going back to the early part of this cycle, there, and maybe even going back to the CAFTA vote, which was in July 2005, there's just a simmering tension as it relates to how to deal with trade and globalization policies. CAFTA, you might recall, was just a one or two vote win for the Bush administration, but public opinion, I think, was certainly on the side of an anti-NAFTA, anti-CAFTA sentiment. And so I think since then there was just a bubbling around the country, and we saw more than 100 candidates for the House, Senate, and governor running pretty clearly on an anti-NAFTA, CAFTA model platform, and candidates that, you know, were spending money on this in television advertisements, you know, over 25 or 30 ads to talk about how they would stand up against that kind of trade policy and try to reverse course. And saw a lot of earned media in a lot of these congressional districts as well, which is, you know, in the election really resulted in a major shift on this issue, and one that I think we can really go back to the NAFTA debate in the early 90s where Clinton, you know, essentially ran on health care, but, you know, a year later delivered us NAFTA. And he himself, you know, was written in his autobiography that the NAFTA vote was a contributing factor to the Republicans taking over the House in 94. It really just depressed turnout amongst particularly middle-class Democrats who thought, well, if these guys aren't going to stick up for me in Congress, well, you know, what's the point? And so I think that we've really come, you know, full circle, or at least this is a major step forward towards reconnecting Democrats with middle-class economic issues, and trade is central to that.
Well, one of the things that Lori Wallach from Global Trade Watch had pointed out was that this election sort of diffused the myth of the trade debate being divided between pro-traders and protectionists, because it fell out kind of more complicated than that.
It certainly is, yeah. I think it becomes easy for editors to fall back on the anti-trade people as being simply protectionists or isolationists. It's laziness, I think, that contributes a lot to that, and I think the critique is a lot broader than that. You know, Sherrod Brown, the senator-elect from Ohio, is being, you know, trumpeted a lot as being kind of symbolic of this national trend right now. And he's an internationalist opponent to this policy. I mean, people listen to him. He talks a lot about what this policy has done abroad and what NAFTA has done in Mexico, in addition to what it's done to workers here in America. So I think that there is a broader critique out there, and it takes, you know, some of the more enterprising reporters to go out and find it.
Yeah, so it's harder to put people in that box. That doesn't mean reporters won't try. I always remember a USA Today story that said that the activities of the World Trade Organization, they described them as being little noticed by the public, but said they had energized activists around the world. I find that globalization and trade issues are an area where the disconnect between the public and the press becomes very vivid. Here people lose their membership in the public once they become active around trade issues. In that light, I wonder what you've made of the media response to the election in terms of trade. There has been some coverage of this.
Yeah, it's unquestionably a story that I think at this point every major national newspaper has taken a crack at, from USA Today to the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times and Washington Post. And I think that they're struggling to kind of handle it in a way. I mean, again, it's undeniably a story, and they either pigeonhole the dissent that's out there into, you know, the protectionist line. And I think there's always been dissent to these trade agreements out there, and usually they pin that as being in the minority, kind of an also-ran in the bottom of a story. But now, you know, very clearly, I think this election affirms that the dissent is in the majority, and so they're caught off guard a little bit. And the New York Times especially, I think its trade narrative often, you know, they use like North and South Carolina textile workers as kind of the dissent out there. And then when they do their big trade piece or try to illustrate the dissent, you know, they often fall into that kind of mold. And it's, of course, a lot more broad than that right now and widespread across the country.
The Los Angeles Times had an editorial on the 15th in which they said the cause of free trade may be in for a rough time once Democrats take control of both houses of Congress. And they use the term protectionist, and they say fast-track trade authority is endangered and that all of this is unfortunate. What strikes me is what they say next. They're talking about, this is in the context of Vietnam, where trade talks broke off. They say, quote, Vietnam is far from the only country where free trade has made a profound difference. Open markets create customers for U.S. goods and provide cheap imports for U.S. consumers while improving relations around the world and boosting economies. A successful Doha round would probably do more to relieve poverty in Africa than all the foreign aid doled out to the continent put together, close quote. I guess my question to you, Chris Slevin, is, you know, what's wrong with you that you don't want to relieve poverty in Africa?
Yeah, that's the prevailing frame. And I think just taking a step back from that, fundamentally, I think there's a real disconnect literally in newsrooms and as far as, you know, national papers. I've been working in media relations around trade for a number of years, so I feel like I have some experience and have worked with a lot of reporters, and, you know, most are, you know, hardworking, earnest reporters, but they often come out of, you know, really good schools, and they're taught that free trade is a no-brainer, slam dunk positive, and any dissent from that is just flat out wrong. And I think that is reflected in a lot of the coverage, where a lot of reporters might have, frankly, more in common with diplomats and ambassadors than they might with steel worker or even some high-tech workers in the Northwest or you know, elsewhere. I think that there is just a fundamental disconnect that exists in newsrooms. And as you guys well know, there are not a lot of labor reporters out there anymore, a lot of papers that have a labor beat. There's workplace reporters or people that kind of cover, you know, work from more of a style or trend angle, but there's not a lot of, other than, you know, say Stephen Greenhouse at the New York Times and a couple other reporters, you know, here and there. There's not a beat really that's dedicated to looking at how middle class workers are really handling the global economy right now.
Well, I read that quote because it just sounds so Pollyanna, you know, improving relations around the world and boosting economies. It sounds so simple-minded.
It's kind of a dogma, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that a lot is based on faith. And I think that we also have 10 or 12 years of lived experience under NAFTA and WTO, which shows that really the majority of people worldwide in rich and poor countries are not better off under this model.
Well, let me ask you finally, the point of this election would seem to be that despite elite media's kind of simple-minded proselytizing, ordinary people seem to be getting beyond this, if you are for good and light, you support free trade at every turn line. I wonder what you think economic activists might take away from this in terms of future organizing.
Well, I think that, and I think you see this in a lot of progressive activism, that, you know, we'll still work with the major media and try to get the message out, but it's not going to be the end-all be-all, too. I think that there's a lot more different resources, certainly on the internet and blogs, and I think that in this election, too, there's a lot more kind of neighbor-to-neighbor activism, kind of following a model that Move On and Americans for Democratic Action, several other groups have used to really just make it more grassroots-based. And I think that a lot of campaigns, too, have recognized that, you know, they're going to spend money on ads and media, but at the same time, there is definitely a lot more out there, and that these people will come out and vote if you reach them, and you don't have to rely on the New York Times or LA Times editorial board to reach them.
We've been speaking with Chris Slevin. He's Deputy Director of Global Trade Watch at Public Citizen. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.